joining us. I'm Diane Rehm.
The truth is, I want to be completely honest here, there is no perfect, painless silver bullet out there that solves every problem, gives everybody perfect health care for free. There isn't.
That may be the one statement that President Obama made on Saturday on which all sides in the health care debate can agree. But there are many questions, many rumors about what a health care overhaul would or could mean. Here in the studio with me to answer your questions about an issue that affects us all, C.C. Connolly of the Washington Post, Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News, and the Politico's Carrie Budoff Brown. And we are going to open the phones right away. I have one question first, though, for you, C.C. Connolly. Over the weekend, we heard Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius say that perhaps the public option may be dropped. And then the president said that the public option is only a small piece of the broader initiative. How do you interpret all that?
Well, Diane, what Secretary Sebelius said was that this idea of a government-sponsored alternative to the private insurance plans is not the essential element. That was the phrase that she used, which if you're sort of reading the tea leaves here in Washington on the health care debate, you spotted an opening for compromise. This is not astonishing. I think that the administration has been surprised that this particular element has become such a lightning rod in the debate. And it has really been interpreted very differently by very different players. There are some people who say that it is simply the first step toward a single-payer system. That would be a government-run health system, the way we see in Canada and much of Europe. Others say, no, it's really just the idea of having a nonprofit option for people who are having trouble in the private insurance market, maybe who can't afford it, can't get good insurance coverage. They'd have a place to go and shop for insurance that would hopefully be more affordable. President Obama likes to use the phrase that he thinks it would keep the insurance companies honest, almost sort of be a counterbalance to some of those for-profit industries. But we're certainly seeing movement away from that, and I think it's the reality of votes in the Senate.
Mary Agnes Carey, how do you see it? Do you see it as a beginning of compromise to try to reach some healthy agreement on this health care plan?
I absolutely think it is. I think they're signaling that they know in the Senate, that the public plan is going to have a difficult time getting enough votes. There's been a lot of discussion there about these cooperatives, co-ops. Kent Conrad, who heads the Finance Committee, has been talking about those and other members of the Senate. And there's a feeling that if they go the co-op route, there'll be more bipartisan support in the Senate, which will be key to passing that bill.
Can you explain the co-op route?
The idea is looking at co-ops. They're looking at co-ops all over the country, that electrical co-ops, for example. There are other sort of locally or regionally controlled operations where local to regional officials define what the needs are, what the plan would be, and how it would look. And the idea is it's the best option for a particular state or a particular region versus the idea of one government-run option offered to everyone.
Carrie Budoff Brown, do you think that a co-op system would not only win support in the Congress, but could find a way to work around the country?
On the political legislative question, I think it's still unclear. There's support within this small bipartisan group of negotiators on the Finance Committee for it. But beyond that, we haven't yet seen the more liberal factions, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, accept this. Who want the robust public option. They're skeptical or not yet sold on the idea that a co-op can work in the same way that they believe a public government run option can work. And they're going to need some convincing, because there is a stalwart group there that says co-ops are unproven. There's only two in the country that work, or proven to work.
One in South Dakota.
And Washington is
in Washington.
Washington State. And then there's another one in some other Midwestern state. So this is not necessarily a proven model, and they're not yet convinced.
No, just to follow up, the Puget Sound one is getting a lot of attention, but there's a lot of concern that if you don't have one uniform federal offering, that benefits could be different depending on where you live. And to Carrie's point, the progressives of the party want one government-administered option to provide that uniformity for everyone, no matter where you live in the country.
Cece.
We've also heard some objections, again, from some of the more progressive members of Congress who say, wait a second, running a utility, an electric utility, is a little different than delivering health care to thousands or tens of thousands of individuals in a region. It does get certainly more complex. I don't think that means that it's impossible. As Mary Agnes says, it's the Puget Sound co-op is touted to be working quite well. But that said, it's not quite as simple as some folks might hope.
So would you say now that you believe, from what you've heard, that the public option is off the table?
No, it's not off the table at the moment. I think all of the evidence suggests that the House bill, whatever merged version of these various bills in the House committees ends up on the House floor, will almost certainly contain a public option, a fairly robust, as we like to say, public option, because the progressive wing of the House Democratic Caucus is quite influential. That said, there's a long way to go from a House vote to potentially President Obama signing a law. And I think as we get further along in that process, it's more likely to drop out.
Cece Connolly of The Washington Post, Mary Agnes Carey. She is senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Carrie Budoff Brown is health reporter for Politico. 800-433-8850. Here's our first email. And as you can imagine, we've been receiving tweets, emails, and Facebook messages all weekend long. Here's one from Nathan in Baltimore. People say they like the health insurance they've got, but do they realize there's no reason to believe they'll get to keep it if nothing is done? He says, I work for a small company and have had my health insurance coverage changed 3 times in the past 4 years.
Yeah, that is, we were hearing very, very often from President Obama saying, if you like what you have, you can keep it. If you like your doctor, you can keep it. But there's been a number of questions raised about that statement, because at any time now, there's no guarantee that any employer has to keep the coverage they have or keep the type of insurance company that they have. And there's no guarantee in this new system that will stay the same. So right now, there's no guarantee your coverage will stay the same, and there is no guarantee in the future. Though the president, and he's had a rough go of this in some ways, because a lot of people are questioning this statement as not being entirely airtight. He's trying to say we're going to keep the employer-based system. So generally speaking, this is not going to be a dismantling of the health insurance system as we see it now.
Cece.
Well, I think Nathan has hit on a very important point, which is all of the uncertainty and instability in today's system. The rise and costs are forcing many employers to rethink what sort of health insurance they provide for their employees. Some are doing away with it entirely. Others are cutting back, changing plans, as Nathan pointed out 3 times in his case. Separate and distinct are the promises that President Obama is trying to make out there on the campaign trail. And I think it's a little bit unfortunate, because what he is trying to do is reassure people that he doesn't want to upend the entire existing system. He uses language language such as I'd like to build on it, and that has meant for some confusion.
Mary Agnes.
I think that Nathan's issues are something the president has tried to use to his benefit to say to folks, look, if we don't do anything, you could lose your health insurance. You might not have it at all. And the toughest thing the president has to do is reach out to the people that have health insurance and explain what's in this bill for them. This
all
is
right.
One of the guarantees.
To Dallas, Texas. Stan, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. Pleasure to be on the show. I am a physician, and I do medical director work for various kinds of health care plans, including Medicare and Medicaid. My question is, the poor uninsured are in both the House bill and the Senate health bill going to be moved into the Medicaid system. And I think as many as 10 million poor uninsured would be moved into that system. Right now, I know in Texas, there are not enough doctors to care for the patients we have today. Only about 40% of physicians in Texas are even in state Medicaid. So it looks like a disaster waiting to happen. I hope these people get covered, but that's not a very good way of doing it.
All right, CZ.
Well, Stan brings up a very legitimate concern, which is as we begin, hopefully, to provide insurance coverage to many of these 46 million uninsured, where will the primary care doctors be? Because that's what people are really looking for. We know they can go to the emergency department now and get stitched up if there's something urgent. But the idea is with some insurance coverage, Medicaid or some other kind, they'd need a primary care doctor, and that's a challenge.
CC Conley, reporter for the Washington Post. More of your questions, your comments as we look at what's being offered in healthcare overhaul. With our on-air town hall forum, your turn to ask the questions you'd like to have answered in regard to what's out there now, what's being proposed, and understand there are no positives out there yet. The president has not come out with his own bill. The Senate is still debating its bill. The House bill has passed, but there are many, many questions remaining. Here's an email from Penny in Miami who says, I lost my job, which provided the insurance for my husband, too. I'm over 50 with a pre-existing condition and only unemployment benefit for income, but we don't qualify for Medicaid. Under the proposed reforms, how would my husband and I obtain health insurance, Carrie?
Well, that's exactly the type of family that Obama is the president is trying to help with this reform. There's a whole class of people who may not qualify for Medicaid as it currently stands, and so they can't get any insurance. under the reform, if they are up to a certain level of poverty, I think right now it's three times the level of poverty, maybe four times. I'm not sure if any bill still has that. They could qualify for subsidies to go into the insurance exchange. So there would be some government assistance for them to buy insurance in a new marketplace known as an exchange, and they could possibly obtain insurance that way if they qualify.
Mary Agnes.
That's right. That's the plan, to allow people who don't qualify for Medicaid, even though they're going to expand Medicaid coverage, as the last caller mentioned, that they will have subsidies to allow these individuals to go into the private market and the health insurance exchange. And the idea there is, it's very hard right now in the individual market to find health care coverage. It's very expensive. A lot of times, as she noted, if you've got a pre-existing condition, you can't be covered. These are some of the key selling points for the president on his health care plan.
All right. To Dearborn, Michigan. Good morning, Sam.
Yes, good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you so much for raising the level of public debate on this important issue. My question is going to be three-parted, and I'll take my comments off the air afterwards. But number one, I'd like to know why President Obama, it seems to be, in my opinion, kowtowing to the lobbyist interest groups of the insurance companies by negotiating perhaps the possibility of dropping a public option, which would offer some remedy to the uninsured like myself. I'm currently 55, a substitute teacher, don't have coverage because simply I can't afford private coverage, but I was hoping that perhaps there might be some public option I could take advantage of at a discounted rate because I'm a single male. And I also have a neurological disorder that impedes my handwriting. It's called focal dystonia. So I'm just wondering, with the private insurance, whether or not I can even get coverage. And secondly, is there some kind of pragmatic outlook with President Obama, thinking that perhaps he needs to do this to back away from the public option just to get something through? Or is it perhaps he's just kowtowing business as usual to the insurance lobby? And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling. Cece.
Well, Sam, you're very perceptive. I think that most would agree that President Obama is a fairly pragmatic leader. And what he is trying to do is search for the art of the possible, as we like to say in Washington. With respect to some of the industry deals that the White House has negotiated in part with the Senate Finance Committee and the industries, such as the drug companies, hospitals, Walmart had a deal as well. What Obama has been trying to do is neutralize some of the most potent forces that were against health care reform in 1993-94, and that also includes, to a certain extent, the insurers. You think back to those Harry and Louise ads. So, yes, he is certainly trying to neutralize that opposition. Unfortunately, what he's discovered in the hot days of August here is that that has not been sufficient to translate into broad public support.
Mary Agnes.
To Cece's point, he's got to keep these folks at the table. The drug makers, the health insurers, other lobbying, big employer groups, if they say we're out, that's really going to hurt chances for prospects for health care reform to pass this year. And passing it this year is a political necessity for the president and the Democrats. This is how, what's one of the key issues for President Obama. It's how he helped win the election. It helped Democrats take control of both chambers. So I think he's doing his best to remain flexible, open, accommodating to get something done this year.
Carrie.
And just to your caller's point about whether he could still get insurance, though, if the public option does not make the final bill, he could still, I think the idea is still that he could get insurance through a private insurer. There would be rules now on insurers that he could not discriminate based on pre-existing conditions. So someone like your caller can theoretically, or, that is the hope, that he will be able to afford insurance on the private market. The question right now is whether the insurance will be affordable enough, and that's why people say there should be a public option, because then that will lower the costs or that will make a system more competitive. But I think the idea still is for someone like your caller to be able to get insurance.
Cece.
That's absolutely correct, and that's what Obama has been talking about out on the trail, or these insurance market reforms.
Here's a message from Facebook, and a great many people have asked us this question. What about malpractice insurance for doctors? I've heard more than one tell me that their malpractice premiums force them to raise costs. Will anything be done? within this legislation to rein in malpractice insurance? Mary Agnes.
I think it's highly unlikely. Democrats have shown no interest now. It's not in the bill. Critics of the Democratic Party will say this is because they're so closely aligned with trial lawyers. That's been a criticism for Democrats. But right now they're focused on a lot of other things, not medical malpractice.
Carrie.
But I think there's two things we have to remember, though. When Max Baucus, the Senate Finance Committee chairman, put out a white paper at the end of last year, he said that any reform, any legitimate attempt at reform, should have some malpractice reforms in it. And President Obama went to the AMA and talked about not caps, but caps on malpractice awards, but other kinds of programs, Sorry Works, which are, you know, saying you're sorry and going to an arbitration system. There are ideas out there, and though it's not in discussion in the Finance Committee, it's really a Judiciary Committee matter, and there may be some attempt to put forward an amendment on the floor. And I think that may very well happen, because there is this, you've already had the president, you had Max Baucus say, we do need to look at this. I don't know if it's actually going to happen, but it's not outside the realm of possibility.
What about the September 15th deadline? Cece, is it likely to be met?
Well, the September 15th deadline is for supposedly the Gang of Six negotiators in the Senate Finance Committee to emerge from behind closed doors magically with a bill, finally. We've been waiting for many months for this. Interestingly, and Mary Agnes gets at the point of why this year is such a critical timetable for President Obama and congressional Democrats. They want to get it done before the 2010 midterm elections heat up. That said, Senator Conrad, one of those six negotiators, said on Sunday on television that he does not feel bound by that deadline at all, and that has to worry the White House.
I think it will be tough. They're on break until after Labor Day. They don't come back to the Senate until early September. To have about a week to get an agreement is awfully difficult. They have said they want to be talking over the break, but I think it's going to be a very tough deadline to meet.
All right, to Penny, who's out in Tombstone, Arizona. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
I'm a retired person, and I have coverage through my former employer, and I think there's so much discussion about how will it be paid for and concern about taxes being increased. But I think there is not enough discussion about what private health care costs. My employer pays almost $1,000 a month in premium. I pay almost $500 a month myself in premium, plus you have thousands of dollars per year in co-pays, deductibles. So how taxes can be higher than that, I have a question.
Mary Agnes.
This gets to a Washington phrase about bending the cost curve, the growth in healthcare costs. That's exactly what she's talking about. This is a key selling point for the president and for Democrats to people who have insurance. Yes, you may currently have it, but can you keep affording it? The hope is that over time, the healthcare reform bill, if it became law, would put changes in the system to make healthcare less expensive so those premiums would go down.
But is that fact or fiction?
Well, it depends on who you talk to.
Exactly.
And in the eyes of the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, some of the things that proponents of health reform say will save money, it's doubtful whether prevention will do that, whether something called comparative effectiveness research, which tries to determine what are the most effective treatments. Ultimately, trying to get scores, if you will, from the Congressional Budget Office is very tough on this to find out. And as we know, the CBO director a few weeks ago told Congress that none of the bills on the table were doing enough. They were actually going to increase costs. They weren't going to reduce them.
So and then that was revised, was it not, Cece?
Yes, that bill was revised. Interestingly, though, Diane, if you get outside of Washington and a lot of this mumbo-jumbo about scoring and talk to people who actually are doctors and nurses and hospital administrators, they say that we can probably never cut cost. We're not going to ever spend less on health care than we do today. But the idea is to slow that rate of growth. And they say that it is possible. And there are places around the country that are doing that right now. Virginia Mason in Seattle, Geisinger in central Pennsylvania. The Mayo Clinic is frequently cited. There are programs all over the country where people are spending their health care dollars more wisely. And it has to do with doing what is proven in the science and not doing the unnecessary, unproven things.
Carrie.
And Diane, just to answer your question, whether it's fact or fiction. Right now, the idea that any of these bills will bend the cost curve technically is fiction because of what Mary said about the CBO. And what they've looked at. But I think what is taking so long in the Finance Committee, why this bill is taking so long to come out, is that's exactly what they're trying to do. They want to put out a bill where the CBO director says this will lower the rate of growth. And that is one of Max Baucus's goals right now, is to get that CBO director to say that at the end of these negotiations. So that's what you have to look for at the end of this process.
Do you believe that can happen, Cece?
Yes, I think that it certainly can. I mean, Doug Elmendorf, who runs the CBO, has certainly talked about a number of ways to make that happen. And we know that the Senate Finance Committee is trying to come in with a bill that's more about $900 billion, so a little under that $1 trillion cost.
All right, let's take a call from Berlin, Germany. Good morning, Carolyn. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I want to say, first of all, because of illness, I'm virtually uninsurable in the U.S., and I've experienced the system in Germany now for 10 years. And I know firsthand that a system with a strong public option and universal coverage can provide high-quality medical care at a reasonable cost with excellent availability. And I'm sorry to see that going off the table. I have two questions about the co-op option. One is, would such an option include restrictions not only against pre-existing conditions, but against being dropped for various reasons before a treatment, or increased premiums tied to one's medical condition? And two, doesn't the co-op option leave us all sort of in every region, in every state, sort of hanging out there to struggle region by region, city by city, to obtain coverage? What is the federal role in a co-op system? I don't really understand that.
Carolyn, I appreciate your call at 27 before the hour. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Her first question, Mary Agnes, would a co-op include restrictions on dropping people who have pre-existing conditions or who develop a problem?
Will depend on how Congress writes the bill. Will they have requirements in the bill that says any co-op, no matter where it is in the United States, has to abide by this, has to not restrict on pre-existing, has to not raise premiums once you get sick? That's really going to be up to Congress to write the law to say that, if that's what they choose to do.
And Cece, her point about leaving people hanging because you're in, say, Washington, D.C., which has one type of co-op, and Los Angeles, California, which has another.
That's precisely the concern if we go to the state or regional cooperative model, as opposed to having at least one national basic approach that would be maybe the minimum levels that would be expected across the country to kind of get at the equity question. And back on the pre-existing conditions question, again, right now, President Obama and most of those Democrats in Congress are saying, whatever bill we come out with, we intend to have those insurance market reforms. And interestingly, the insurance industry has said, we're willing to go along with that if you go ahead and deliver, 40 or 50 million new customers to us. So that's one of the deals that has been struck.
Mary Agnes.
Right. The insurance industry has said, if you have an individual mandate, which would require everyone to have health insurance, we will not exclude coverage based on a pre-existing condition. But the individual mandate, making that requirement, is critical for the insurance company to make good on their promise.
Thanks for calling, Carolyn. I want to ask all of you about what we've seen at these town meetings across the country. Have they been legitimately representative of individuals who have great concerns, and have they been organized by opponents of President Obama and his reform? Mary Agnes.
I think both sides of the debate have tried to get their representatives into these rooms to talk. But I think that the amount of passion that you're hearing, the anger that you're hearing, it just underscores the educational campaign that Congress and the president have to engage in over the next few months to explain to people what is in the bill, what's not in the bill when we get a final, when we do get
when
final bills.
When we finally get some bills.
Right. We have, as you mentioned earlier, we have a bill that's passed three House committees, might be scheduled for a House floor vote in September. We don't have a Senate bill yet. There's a lot of education, a lot of work to be done that's been out there.
Carrie.
I mean, this stretch of these few weeks where it's been difficult, this is precisely why the president wanted to have the ball moved further down the field by now. Because if he had had bills through all the both the Senate and the House, it would be more of a backroom process in September when you're trying to merge the bills for a conference committee. So both sides are organizing. I think we would have seen this type of emotion and reaction to this bill at some point, no matter what.
Cece.
I also believe that some of the emotion that we're seeing out there ties in with the recession, Diane. The fact of the matter is that there are still a lot of families out there hurting. We've been hearing from some of them this morning, and health insurance becomes one of those many financial burdens that they're grappling with right now. And change is always frightening, and a lot of people are very nervous about the unknown.
Cece Connolly of The Washington Post, Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News, Carrie Budoff Brown. She's a health reporter for Politico. More of your questions when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. By the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide on the web at fordfound.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
How a Sandlot baseball game prompted a middle-class family to take in five boys from the projects. It's a story of discovery, the true meaning of family, and bridging the racial and socioeconomic divide. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Here's a tweet from Juby, who says, I'd prefer a public option, but getting reform to happen at all seems to be the most important task. Do you think reform will happen, Cece?
Oh, my goodness. That's always the hardest question. I don't know. I mean, generally speaking, in Washington, the safe bet is always on inaction. That said, President Obama has control of both the House and the Senate. He does have the vote advantage on Capitol Hill. He's investing a lot of his own political capital on this right now. So I don't think we should write him off by any means.
Carrie, do you think it'll happen?
Well, I think the tweet goes to the point that in the last few days, we've seen some top-level Democrats saying we need to get something this year. We cannot just disregard a bill because it doesn't include everything we want. Whatever the basis of what President Obama's looking to do these insurance market reforms are pretty huge as they are. And it wouldn't be as if this would be just a waste not to do in the eyes of Democratic leaders such as Bill Clinton, others who are saying, you know, the liberal base, you cannot just turn your back on reform because you're not going to get the public option or a couple of other things.
All right. And from Facebook, here is a message. What is health insurance reform without a public option? I can't believe this issue is being hijacked by people who want to defeat it just because. Last Sunday, Newt Gingrich was spouting off about death panels when George Stephanopoulos asked him if he had actually read the bill. Newt said, no, it's over 1,000 pages long. It's clear they're just making things up. I have one question. If not now, when? Cece, let's go to this issue of the death panels.
There is nothing in the legislation that would create in any way, shape, or form death panels.
How did this all begin?
There is a provision in the House version that would reimburse doctors under Medicare to do a consultation with any patient. It would be voluntary.
Who wanted it?
Any patient who said, I would like to talk to you about my end-of-life care, what my preferences are, whether or not you want a great intervention towards the end of life, or perhaps, as we've learned from much research, many, many people who say, no, I don't want to be hooked up to a lot of tubes in a hospital with noises beeping. I would like to be at home in my bed with maybe my family or my pets.
Hospice care.
A personal preference. But the idea being that right now doctors are not paid to do that consultation. Doctors are pressed for time. They're squeezed financially in many instances as well. So this would be a way to reimburse them, say, for that 30-minute conversation. Much of this started with a woman by the name of Betsy McCoy, who did serve as the lieutenant governor of New York some number of years ago. She's also known in healthcare circles for being one of the leading opponents of the Clinton healthcare effort in 1993-94, writing a number of critiques of that that really had a very devastating impact. She started this with some writings and appearances on talk radio, and it has really just mushroomed since then.
Carrie?
Soon after she went on the Fred Thompson show in mid-July, I actually got her on the phone and asked her why she was saying this when this is... It's clear that it's not required. The Medicare benefit is not required. And she said, well, in so many words, it is. So she sort of acknowledged at that point that the bill does not require this. It's a voluntary action. But she kind of had her own view of what was in that bill.
Where did the phrase death panels first begin?
I believe it was Sarah Palin, the former governor of Alaska, who really stepped this up a notch in terms of emotional intensity when she then invoked the situation with her own child, an autistic child, and said, it is possible under this scenario that I and my autistic child would have to go before one of these government panels. And that has really upset and frightened so many people. And I just want to say again, there is nothing in the legislation that approaches that.
Mary Agnes.
I think it shows that there's great distrust when Washington tries to do something as comprehensive as overhauling the healthcare system. Even though it's not in the language at all, the sort of scenarios that you're portraying, even yesterday, Charles Grassley, who's the ranking Republican on the Finance Committee, suggested in a statement that it is worrisome in a bill where you want to reduce healthcare costs to have this sort of counseling raise, to get this sort of he sort of built the bridge of the idea that if you have this sort of end of life counseling, that perhaps people may be forced into some decisions they may or may not want to make because they'll be pressured to reduce healthcare costs. But I think it is clear, as Cece has noted, that this language is not written that way in the bill.
All right, to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Diane. I am, as I've listened to the discussion over the phone, waiting, a number of things have changed. But what you've just been saying, first of all, I believe that Governor Palin's child has Down syndrome.
Yes, she does.
Pardon me, yes.
That's okay. What troubles me and what the discussion has just gotten around to, is the fact that if you try to base an argument on lies, you can't come to any valid conclusions. Right now, the opposition to health care reform is forwarding these two arguments that are, to my mind, contradictory. The first is no government program is any good. But the second is no private insurer can compete against the government. I don't know why they don't follow through to the third part of the syllogism. Therefore, private insurers are worse than the government.
I think you hit your nail on the head, Cece.
Yes, Richard, and let me apologize again for misspeaking about Governor Palin's son. You are correct. But on this point, you're raising an excellent contradiction in some of these arguments. And interestingly, several weeks ago, Obama tried to kind of call out this seeming contradiction when he had said, hey, wait a second. Why are the insurance industry so upset at the idea of competition when all we hear from them is, let us compete, we can do things better, we can be more efficient? So it is a little bit of a mixed message that you're hearing.
Do you want to add to that, Mary Agnes?
I think there is concern that the government would be undercutting the private insurance sector with prices and this sort of thing. But I think to Cece's point, the president just basically said, let's just have a competition. Let's just see what happens.
All right. To Brooke in Durham, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi there, Diane. Thank you very much for having me on.
Sure.
I had more of a process question, and really it comes down to, you know, the fact that right now, at least in the Senate, it's sort of being held up in the Finance Committee. And like with Ken Conrad and Max Baucus, and my question really was sort of a political question. Why isn't Obama sort of publicly pressuring senators that tend to be in the middle, people like, you know, Max Baucus and Ken Conrad, to just publicly commit to vote that they will vote for cloture, that they will not support a filibuster, because once you do that, then if you can get a bill to a majority vote instead of having to worry about whether or not Olympia Snowe or Chuck Grassley, who's as your panel has just noted, was out talking about like death panels recently, if you don't have to worry about bargaining with them, I think you can actually have a much better chance of realistically passing something.
Carrie.
Yes, that is the one argument that you hear more progressive members of the Senate say, that you can vote against the bill. We should just get the moderate Democrats to commit to voting against a filibuster, and that way we'll get over the 60-vote threshold. Then members who are uncomfortable with it can vote against it on final passage. Pressure from the president hasn't really necessarily worked so well with Max Baucus and Ken Conrad, the idea of putting deadlines on what they do. They've generally resisted it and said, listen, we know what we're doing. Let us do our job.
The simple fact of the matter also is that they don't necessarily have 60 votes. In theory, they do. But unfortunately, we know that Senator Ted Kennedy is quite ill, has not been seen in public for a very long time now. Senator Byrd has been in and out of the hospital a good deal lately. Those would get you presumably to 60 for a procedural motion. But even some of the younger, healthier Senate Democrats, Ben Nelson, Mary Landrieu, Mark Pryor, these are more moderate Democrats who are having a lot of issues with the idea of health reform as well. So there's a good bit of work to do in the Senate.
Are you saying, Cece, that people like Mark Pryor and Mary Landrieu think that health reform should not take place now?
No, but I think that what we are hearing from them is we want it to be done right, is what they say, and we need some time to look this over, to think it through, to see the moving pieces.
All right, and on that point, let's go to Matt in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning.
Hi, Diane, long-time listener. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I just like to read an excerpt from a letter that my mom received in 1979. It says, I believe that we can do better than this in a nation as wealthy and technologically advanced as ours. I believe we are capable and ready to assure health care to all of our people as a matter of right. In the same way that we assure a decent education, this was Eunice Kennedy's brother in 1979, and my mom received this letter then. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. Carrie.
We could probably go back farther than that to hear the same promises and the same calls that we're hearing today. It's exactly the same going back 40, 50 more years than that. This has been attempted and tried. A lot of the same arguments against reform have been used for 40 to 50 years. We heard President Obama talk about how the argument of socialism, the concerns about socialism were used in the 1960s to hurt Medicare.
Let's talk about socialism for a moment, Mary Agnes. Where is this coming from, and how real is the argument?
I think there's concern among some members of Congress that if you have a public plan, it will be the beginning of socialized medicine. Private insurers won't be able to compete. They'll drop out. The government will assume an even larger portion of healthcare spending, and it's kind of the beginning of the step towards socialized medicine. But to the point you just raised earlier in the last caller, I think that there's a large discussion going on in this country of what kind of country do we want to be? For example, do we want as many uninsured Americans as we have now? Do you want people in fear of, I'll lose my health insurance if I get really sick, I won't be able to get it if I have a pre-existing condition? Those voices are also in the debate, and I think that that is a large part of this debate that will continue to grow, as well as more of some of the more attacks on the specific provisions of the bill. There are people that just say, isn't this time that we look at this as a nation and do something about it?
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. A question coming from lots of folks. Is the opposition to health care reform coming from people who want President Obama to fail? Carrie.
That certainly is a percentage of it, or a piece of it is from some Republicans. We've heard Senator Jim DeMint in his now famous Waterloo comments saying that we could use this to break the president. There's a certain element of the party that believes that, but not to underestimate just what my, you know, fellow guests here have talked about. I mean, there's a real fear, you know, and some real concerns about a huge overhaul of this magnitude. And you know, questions should be asked of representatives and members of Congress what this means.
CC.
Yeah, there are certainly legitimate questions to be raised. I don't think anybody is taking a look at the proposals on the table so far and saying, yes, brilliant, perfect, all done. Healthcare is complicated. It is one out of every $6 spent in this country goes to healthcare today. In many communities, hospitals are the largest employer. There are very real world impacts to anything that's done.
Now, President Obama has said on the issue of rationing, which has certainly come up in many public forums, President Obama has said health insurance reform will end current forms of rationing, not expand it. First, there is widespread rationing in today's system. Right now, decisions about what doctor you can see, what treatment you can receive, are made by insurance companies. What about the rumors and the statements at public forums that there will be healthcare rationing? Mary Agnes.
I think this is the fear of the unknown. The president talked a lot about the debate in his mind where healthcare reform is hope versus fear. There's concern that there will be rationing, but to your point, he's saying it already exists in the current system. And if you don't do anything about health care as it currently exists, we'll have more rationing. So he's hoping that argument is going to resonate with the fears of individuals who fear that a big health care reform bill will somehow restrict their ability to get health care.
Cece.
I think that the goal is rational rationing. We can't have everything. We can't afford everything. I mean, that's increasingly clear. Health care is eating up all of our family budgets and our companies. And yes, indeed, there is plenty of rationing in the system now. The question is, could we do a better job of prioritizing and figuring out what health care makes sense? What are the things that will lead us to a healthy nation, as opposed to a nation that just gets more and more tests and drugs and treatments and spends more and more?
Carrie.
Yeah, I think CeCe's exactly right. So is Mary. There's rationing in the system now. I think the idea is that, you know, the insurance industry, they decide right now what treatments you should receive. And the president had a pretty line over the weekend that resonated, it seems, with the audience. They gave him a standing ovation. He says, I don't want to put a government bureaucrat in between you, but right now insurance bureaucrats are standing between you and your health care.
Well, it's clear that we need far more time for this kind of town forum up the air. So I promise you in September, or whenever we see a health care bill come forward, we'll do it for 2 hours and we'll try to answer as many questions as possible. CeCe Conley, Mary Agnes Carey, and Carrie Butoff Brown, thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.